Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Cersei Institute Podcast Network. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm David Kern, and I quickly wanted to say a word of thanks to some of our friends who are making this show possible. Our friends over at the CLT, the Classic Learning Test, are doing an amazing work. They're a classically based alternative to the SAT and the ACT, and it's the fastest growing college entrance exam in America today. More than 90 colleges now accept the CLT, and many of them even endorse the CLT as their preferred admissions test. That's even more than the SAT and the ACT. Students who take the test can benefit from same-day test results and can share their scores with colleges for no additional charge. To learn more or to find out how to take a test, you can head over to cltexam.com. Again, to register for the CLT, you head over to cltexam.com. So again, thanks so much to our friends over at the Classic Learning Test for sponsoring the Cersei Institute Podcast Network this month. It's because of them and partners like them that this network is possible. And with that, enjoy your show. Thanks for listening.
Hello again, and welcome to Ask Andrew, episode 16. I'm Andrew Kern, and I have the privilege of having my daughter, Katerina Julia Kern, with me today. And those of you who have been following along know that we've been talking about the question of cross-cultural education, of whether classical education is something that is just for pale-faced Westerners, or is it for everybody? And Katie's had some really, really helpful insights for me. And I think one of the things that she brought out in the last episode, I'd never really thought of it quite this way before, is that anytime you approach a great book, anytime you approach a great work of art, anytime you approach an unknown truth, let's say, you're always approaching as a stranger. And that's really profound. It's interesting, though, now that I think about it, we did a conference a couple years back, if that long ago, and David Hicks did a talk on what he called philoxenia, which means love of the stranger. Mm-hmm. And we did talk there about the I think it was more personal. I think it was more about student to teacher, parent to child. But it's possible. I should listen to those talks again and see if we went into the issue that when you approach a text, you're approaching as a stranger. And we feel it. Mm-hmm. We do. Yeah. We feel it. We feel scared. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, when you just draw back and think about it, most of the people who say they don't like a book or they don't like a movie or they don't want to read something, sometimes it's just that there is so much out there to read and watch and so on. But I think at the root of a lot of it is just the simple fact that it's strange to us, mm-hmm, by virtue of the fact that we don't know it, mm-hmm, and we don't want to be unsettled.
And it's complicated as well, because in order to learn about something, you have to first know about something. You have to first have context. You have to first meet something before you can learn more about that thing, whatever it might be. And so I think as teachers, frequently, we just try and teach about something. We give the information or we share the knowledge, but we don't first introduce and go through the painful, really, process of meeting something first before we then learn about it.
Just reach out and shake hands with the...
Yeah.
A new thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have to know something about something before we can learn about that thing.
I've been making this point since the first episode that we learn things as caricatures first. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think students would benefit if we would let them do that more.
Yeah.
We try, for example, with The Lost Tools of Writing, we try with lesson one, we basically present a caricature of writing.
Yeah.
We say to the participants, what are your challenges when you write? And then there's only three. Mm-hmm. If you can come up with something to say, order your thoughts, and express them appropriately, you can write. Problem solved. In caricature terms. Mm-hmm. Now we need to get the details. So I think it would be good for us as teachers to be better at introducing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the trouble is to introduce somebody to a caricature or something is, we have to have enough awareness of that thing that we're introducing them to identify what its caricature is.
Yes.
And we have to be able to say, maybe I only have a caricature here.
And we have to know the students well enough to know where their knowledge ends and where the introduction begins.
That's why mimetic teaching begins with the preparation stage.
Yes.
Stories, context, things like that. Mm-hmm. And for that one, people who are wondering what I'm talking about, episode 12, we talk about that a little bit. Or take the apprenticeship.
Yeah.
Let me come back to the Kenya email.
Yeah.
I read a bit of it last time, and because it's not a terribly long email, but it goes into deep thoughts that will distract me. I'm going to jump to where we left off last time. For us to appreciate our African culture and examine the beliefs, values, and morals that have undergirded this culture historically is imperative. I would like your thoughts on this. And that's what we talked about a bit. Mm-hmm. Moving on then, I desire help in putting together such a curriculum for use in Kenya and the African continent and all who would choose to use it from the Western and perhaps Eastern civilizations. Mm-hmm. I love this idea. And In a way, I'm not sure what issue we're addressing. Does classical education value African culture? You know what? I'm going to put it in that explicit a question.
Okay.
Katie.
Yes.
Does classical education value African culture, or does it want to replace it with a new culture?
That really depends on what you mean by classical education and the manifestation of that. Some of the questions that have been asked, and particularly this one, I'm wondering if the question means by classical education, specifically the content of classical education. And I would argue a little bit differently from my father on this, that when we're teaching, we can only really teach or learn four things. Dad minimizes it down to three, but I say four.
What are my three?
I don't remember, but I remember you had three. Okay. I added habits. I think that we can teach habits, skills, facts, and ideas.
Once again, when we talk about this later on, I'll explain where you fall short of understanding.
Right. And I will add, clearly, habits are an important thing that we can teach. So it would be one of the four. So it sounds to me initially like people are asking, is the content that we teach in classical education honoring to African culture? Mm. And to that, I would say generally it's not. Which is a problem that we need to address. Generally, the way that it's frequently reproduced in American schools is not honoring to African cultures, and that should be resolved. But that's the content specifically. I would argue that the other things that we teach, the habits, the skills, and the ideas, are very much honoring to African culture. So 1/4 of the general manifestation of classical education in America is falling short, but that doesn't mean that all of it is. It's, of course, a caricature of what we see in classical education. But I think that once you are willing to embrace all four elements of classical education, you're not just looking at it as simply, you know, a curriculum list of subjects that you need to teach. If you can move beyond that, I think you can pick and choose the parts of the curriculum that are honoring or that fit within what you're trying to teach your African-American or African students. And you can feel liberated by that. I don't think that classical education should be a bondage or a set of rules that we have to follow, a set of books that we absolutely have to teach. I think that we can feel the freedom to pick and choose, even still being classical. So that initially, that's my response.
Are there any that you would regard as essential, that you're not giving a classical education if you don't read this book anywhere in the world?
Well, I do think that you would need Homer. I do think you would need the Bible. Apart from that, probably not. Maybe Virgil. I think, well, one, and this might be a digression, Homer himself and even Virgil, those texts are fundamentally tribal. We're dealing with tribal conflicts in those texts. And so as I have been reading those with my students, they have enlightened me so much on why Achilles would be so upset, why Aeneas needed to take his wife, and why the war blew up because of that. All of these different things in those texts.
Agamemnon,
my
you
students.
Mean?
No, sorry, Aeneas, when he gets all the way to Italy. In the Aeneid, in Virgil.
He needed to take his wife?
When he takes the princess who was engaged to... Oh, the names. They're getting me.
Oh, you're in the second half now.
I was switching to Italy. The second half of Virgil, yeah, right, after okay. He arrives in Italy.
Yeah.
When he chooses a wife who's essentially engaged to a different clan
right.
member.
Right.
Which is more interesting.
It starts with
relationship
an L,
with strangers. Yes, Lavinia, thank you. So I think that those texts are very, very easily taught within an African context.
In my experience, the people who like Homer the least are suburban white people.
I'm not surprised by that in the least.
I find people like it in every other culture I've ever interacted with.
My students absolutely love Homer. They soak it up. They read it for fun. They ask me to read it on the weekends.
Katie has told me stories about how they have acted out or taught Homer's epics. And if we get a chance, I would love to talk about those in these podcasts. She's only here for a little while, so I don't know, maybe we'll do a whole stream of sidecasts or something like that. But sorry to interrupt. It's fascinating to hear her stories. And I remember you telling me, for example, that you got excited once as though it was quite a revelatory thing that here was, I think it was Odysseus, was doing something very hospitable, very generous to a guest.
Yes.
And you said, isn't that fantastic? And they looked at each other sort of lifting their brows and saying, yeah, isn't that what you do? Do you remember this?
Yeah. When Odysseus arrives on the island,
Circe's
with the princess.
Island? Oh, yeah,
who,
yeah. Scyria.
Yes.
With the
yes. Yeah. And they welcome him in and they first feed him and they first bathe him and make sure that he's comfortable. And then they ask him his name and why he's there. After welcoming him to their home and giving him meeting all of his needs, they ask him why he's there. I mean, it's just amazing. And so I made that point. Isn't this incredible? And they just looked at me like, duh, what else would you do?
Well, what we would do is you would go to the Holiday Inn desk, sign in.
Exactly.
You know, prove that you're who you said you are online.
Yep. Yeah.
It wouldn't be a personal encounter, right?
Yeah.
So, and even in the home, if you don't know a person around in our culture, why did that person even come to your door?
Yes. Yes,
right?
We are
not a hospitable culture.
Right. And most African countries, I don't want to generalize, but most African countries are very hospitable. That's the core of their culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I'd love to discuss with you someday is how can you have a hospitable culture that isn't in turn tribal? Because it seems like there's tribal customs that sustain that. But what was, for example, first, second century Roman culture in the city of Rome, was it hospitable? I don't know.
That would be interesting.
It would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe you should go to a good college and study that.
Be yeah.
So okay, you mentioned Homer, the Bible, and maybe Virgil, and then talked about let's not go there because we talk about those books a lot.
Yeah.
Let me. We're still at the content level.
Should I mention some other books that I use with my students?
I think so. But what I want to get at is the how do you choose what an American kid studies. And how do you choose what an African, a Ugandan, a Kenyan, a Sierra Leonean, Moroccan? How do you choose in those various contexts what the kids there read apart from the ones that we think are universal? Example, okay, I think every American kid should read The Roots of American Order by Russell Kirk.
Okay.
I think that in America is essential.
Yeah.
Because I don't think you can understand... I don't think there's a better book to help us understand our American political roots and cultural roots.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I may be wrong on that. I also think that every American student should memorize the Constitution and should know the story behind every single amendment in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
It would be absurd to suggest that every student in Kenya should do that.
Yes.
But the question becomes why?
Yes.
Right. Why do you pick what you pick and then what do you pick? Now, again, we're sort of getting low on time.
Okay.
You don't have to hurry. I just am saying this is so interesting and it gets so deep all the time.
Yeah.
or get so beautiful. So yeah, talk about how you go about deciding what a person should read in a given place.
Okay. Well, you have to start with what you're trying to teach. Are you trying to teach skills? Are you trying to teach ideas, facts, or habits? So if you're trying to teach skills, let's say we're looking at English or history, you may be teaching the skill of historical questioning. How do we go about the process of learning things about history? Well, then you definitely need to be presenting primary source material to your students. Go as far back as you can and find text from whatever country it is that you're teaching in. And from that, give them the skill to be their own historian.
Now, you're in Uganda. And in Uganda, the culture has been utterly devastated by Idi Amin, the AIDS crisis. The oral culture has been, as I understand it, largely, not completely, but largely broken.
Right.
And then when the British were there for about 80 or 100 years, and it was a colony, there was one tribe that was exalted over all the other tribes. And it seems to me that what you're talking about now would be really hard in Uganda. What would you do to help a Ugandan? I mean, see, in the States, maybe we're in decline. Maybe we're coming to an end. Who knows? But we have a lot of documents, a lot of discussion. We can easily engage in it. In Uganda, there's an attempt to build, almost from scratch, a new civilization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Help me think that through a little bit. Okay,
well,
time's up.
I think for one is we're looking at Uganda today and we're trying to determine what text to use today. First, especially because of colonization and what that has done to Uganda, as the white man entering in, we need to set ourselves aside and say, here's what we have. Here are the facts that we know. Here are the primary source materials that we have. But now you guys tell us your story. For me, teaching in Uganda is about enabling the Ugandans to tell their own story because we can tell
powerful.
Them time and time again their own story, but we're still the white men telling them their story, and we can't do that anymore. It's just time's up on that. We need to give them the skills to read materials, to understand, do the historical process, engage with historical methodology in the best, most excellent form possible. Look at primary
source
materials.
But isn't that already a white Western thing, this historical primary source material? Isn't that already?
Well, I think it is if you're disregarding oral tradition. But I think if you can respect the oral tradition and the oral cultures and let the students bring to it the stories their grandparents have told them, I don't think that it has to be specifically Western. So I very frequently ask my students to tell me about their childhood, the stories that their grandparents have told them, the stories that they've learned growing up, and to bring that into their understanding of Uganda and their place in Uganda and the culture there. So part of it is teaching them the skills to write their own history. Part of it also is giving them the skills to express their own ideas. I mean, that's what Shakespeare did. Shakespeare became Shakespeare because he read Homer and because he grew up in classical education.
Did he read Homer? I know he was driven by Virgil and Ovid. Did he know Homer?
Well, yes, I think presumably Homer would have been a part of his curriculum, would it not? Homer came to Italy in the 16th century.
Well, Shakespeare was 1590 to 1610, basically. Would he have known Homer?
I guess it's right on the cusp of when Homer was entering into European history, so I'd have to research that.
It was Chapman.
Yeah.
Chapman was around Shakespeare's time. I'd have to check when that was. Anyway,
whether he did or not, he was Shakespeare because of the tradition that was handed down to him. And I think it's time that in Africa, we give them the skills to have their own Shakespeare, to develop their own voice in their own language and express themselves and stop forcing them into English and into Western culture and into our expectations for them.
But when you say we give them the skills, is that still not just Western arrogance, we give them the skills?
Well, I think it's the Greeks and the Romans giving them the skills, like Shakespeare was given.
So we're just transmitting what we received.
Right. If we're saying
And frankly, we've dropped aside. We're not very good at this stuff anymore.
Oh, no, we're terrible. If as Americans we're going to go to Uganda and give them American education, then, well, goodness, I'm not going to go. That's not what this is about. That's not what this is about at all. And we can't act like, as Americans or as the white man in the world today, we somehow have a monopoly on excellent education, because we simply don't.
We don't. No, we don't.
But there was excellent education once.
Well, there have been times when really great education has been practiced in varying places.
Right, and, not fully, yes.
Yeah, and that's what we need to do is strive for the best.
Right.
You know, best practices is what consultants talk at. Well, best practices aren't being done now.
Right, and I mean, one of the most excellently classically educated women in the world was North African, Cleopatra.
She was Greek, though.
Yes, but she was classically educated in
North Africa. Hey.
Augustine of Hippo is African. There's lots of people.
This has been, again, too interesting, and we've gone too far. Too long.
We need to
stop. But I'm going to ask you again. Can you come back for another one?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Bye.
Hey, Katie. I love you.
I love you too.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.